Please be seated. The next case for oral argument is Kenneth Dale Thomas, an appellant versus State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Ellery Gray, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the Appellee State, we have Ms. Caroline Cirska, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Gray, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for your recognition, counsel, colleagues. I'm here this morning on behalf of Mr. Thomason to respectfully request that this court remand this action back to the circuit court with instructions that a judgment of acquittal be entered on each of the convictions that my client sustained after what I've been referring to as the second trial.
Why not a retrial? Why are you entitled to a judgment as a matter of law?
If it's a double jeopardy issue, that would then fall under the res judicata analysis. That would then be a judgment of acquittal based on case law, Ash versus Swenson. Interesting issue. What about that venue question? What should the remedy be there? I think that State versus Iwan gives us the clear answer there, and that is it would also be a judgment of acquittal. The state elected which venue they chose to proceed under. We had asked for the change of venue, so therefore they're stuck with what took place.
Okay.
Of course, subject to the court's questions, which is what I view my primary role to be here, is to answer those. What I would propose to start out with is just a brief recitation of the facts that are relevant to this particular case. The facts presented here in this matter are virtually identical to the previous facts from what I've been calling Thomason 1. For lack of a better term, the story starts with my client and his wife in Leeds, South Dakota. They're the operators, managers, and reside at what was called the Gold Town Hotel. They had asked Mrs. Barbara Langlois, that would be my client's mother-in-law, for various loans over a period of years. Mrs. Langlois complied with that. At one point, though, she requested that there be a quitclaim deed issued to her to secure the loans that she was giving to the couple. Importantly, later at trial, she would testify that that quitclaim deed was only to be used as a security interest, which was ultimately the decision that the court rendered in the first Thomason matter, hey, that's not property of another for purposes of grand theft. But going back to the facts of our story, unfortunately, things between the family broke down. The mother-in-law became concerned that she was never going to be paid back, so she demanded of my client, of her son-in-law, that she be paid back. My client explained, I don't have the money to pay you. Mrs. Langlois then, being very concerned that she's never going to be paid back, then took that quitclaim deed that she had received years earlier, filed it, and had her attorney, Mr. Schreiber, move to evict my client and his wife. That started the next round of negotiations. My client was looking to see how he might be able to pay Mrs. Langlois back. He contacted a Sioux Falls businessman, Mr. Chris Vinson, and started that lease for buyback agreement that was discussed at length by this court in Thomason 1. Mr. Schreiber helped to negotiate the agreement between my client and Mrs. Barbara Langlois. She agreed, okay, you're going to need that quitclaim deed extinguished so that way you've got clear title to make whatever deal you've got worked out. So she agreed to do that. There was a writing to memorialize that. The facts that the court didn't notice up in Thomason 1, but which were in Thomason 1 and also here in Thomason 2, is that when Barbara Langlois executed that quitclaim deed, she didn't merely put Mr. Thomason and Mrs. Thomason's name on it. She also put my client's son name on it, also Ken Thomason. We've been calling him Dale to keep things straightened out. This put my client in a tough spot because to be able to make that lease for buyback deal work in Sioux Falls, he had to have clear title, but now his son's name is also on the title. So what he arranged to, well, according to the facts best presented in the evidence and most favorable to the state, is that he contacted his son while the son was in Illinois. I need this quitclaim deed. Evidence is, sorry, Dad, I'm in Illinois. Can't help you. Mr. Thomason and his wife eventually make their way to Sioux Falls, present a power of attorney purportedly signed by the son, which then allowed them to clear up title, allowed that new deed to be issued for the Gold Town Hotel. It was according to the testimony from the first trial from Mr. Vinson and then from attorney for Getty Abstract in the second trial that they're the ones that then took those documents, which are the basis for the forgery counts, and then had those overnighted to Lawrence County for filing. It was shortly after that that Mrs. Langlois was not paid, and it was discovered that Mr. Thomason and his wife were in the Dominican Republic. Mrs. Langlois was never paid pursuant to the agreement. Eventually, Mr. Thomason was extradited back to this country, went through the first trial. This court reversed those convictions. The state then recharged, or I shouldn't say recharged, but then charged with the new charges, the forgery charges, and of course the offering false or forged instruments for filing, registering, or recording, which would be the deed and that power of attorney that eventually made their way to Lawrence County. Before trial began and at the conclusion of trial, the defense requested that Judge Macy grant a judgment of acquittal or that he dismiss the case with prejudice on the basis of double jeopardy, and in particular, the related or the sub-doctrine of res judicata. Reading the state's brief, my expectation of the clash between us on this particular issue is going to be whether or not res judicata applies in criminal matters, and if so, what would those elements look like or how could it be applied? And so what I would do to perhaps focus this issue is I would start with the analysis that first, res judicata as a doctrine related to double jeopardy clearly does apply to criminal actions in the states of South Dakota. It's an integral part of the Fifth Amendment, which of course is applicable to us in this state under the Fifth Amendment under Benton versus Maryland. It's an incorporated right. The United States Supreme Court recognized that the doctrine of res judicata does apply in criminal matters, and that was in United States versus Oppenheimer, a 1916 case, and that's where we get the quotation about how can it be that these protections apply for debt collection but can't apply in a criminal action where liberty is at stake.
Mr. Gray, you know, before you go any farther on that, we need to define terms here because res judicata really encompasses both issue preclusion and claim preclusion. You've cited the civil test for claim preclusion in your brief. My question to you is, in the criminal context, when the courts are talking about res judicata, aren't they really talking about the Blockberger test?
I would...
That's my question. I mean, there's a lot of issues. Is it claim preclusion, issue preclusion? The tests are different for those two things. But in the final analysis, doesn't it come down to Blockberger? Isn't that what the Supreme Court applies in determining, res judicata, unquote?
I don't believe so. And here would be my analysis as to why not. That argument was essentially raised in United States versus Oppenheimer. I'm going to say that loosely because, of course, Oppenheimer was decided before Blockberger. But in Oppenheimer, the government was arguing, well, wait a minute, res judicata doesn't apply in a criminal context, and the Supreme Court of the United States rejected that. Our then next decision is, of course, the Blockberger, which occurred, I believe, in 32. But importantly, in 1970, we come to Ash versus Swenson. Sort of the same argument was raised in Ash versus Swenson by the prosecutor saying, wait a minute, we've got this Blockberger test. And all of a sudden now the defense is asking that we bring this civil doctrine of collateral estoppel into play. And of course the Supreme Court, I realize it's a divided decision, but they said no, collateral estoppel does apply. They were citing to and using civil standards for the application of that particular test.
But collateral estoppel has a different test than the test you cite in your brief. You cite the test for claim preclusion. Collateral estoppel is issue preclusion.
So they are.
And it's a narrower test. Issue preclusion.
My reading would be that collateral estoppel would be the narrower application. It would almost be setting it up this way. Double jeopardy is the broad doctrine. Then you go to res judicata. Then you would go to collateral estoppel. And that would be my reading from Black Hills Jewelry Manufacturing and versus Falco Jewelry Incorporated, and that's where this court wrote that res judicata is broader and encompasses the doctrine of collateral estoppel. Does that answer the court?
Yes, I think we're on the same page so far. So which test applies in a criminal case? What case tells us what test to apply here?
Well, I don't know that the court has answered that question. The court has not done what I'm asking it to do today, which is to directly apply res judicata to prevent a subsequent prosecution.
The claim preclusion. You're asking us to apply the claim preclusion test. As I read your brief.
Yeah, the four-point test that this court typically uses in the civil arena. That's correct.
Not the issue preclusion, which is collateral estoppel.
Which would be closer to an Ash versus Swenson
right.
type of standard. So, if I'm understanding your question, why should this court adopt, why should this court apply res judicata? And if we do, what would that look like in the criminal context? I don't see any, well, first, I think the United States Supreme Court is very clear that res judicata does apply and that civil litigants and criminal litigants are able to look to that to use it. How does that apply or what does that look like? The court gave us something of an example of that in State versus Anderson. It's a 2005 case. It's styled and captioned as though it sounds like it's a specific criminal case, but what happened in Anderson, it was a vehicular battery and a homicide case out of, if I'm recalling correctly, Minnehaha County, went through trial. He did several post-conviction attacks through habeas corpus, which of course is technically a civil action, but we're still dealing with liberty. After he had filed several challenges, he then came back and filed after those initial challenges were denied by this court in habeas, he then filed a motion to correct an illegal sentence. This court applied res judicata in that matter, as it has in other, I'll call it quasi-criminal contexts when we're dealing with habeas, saying that those issues had already been raised, he would be precluded, and of course this court in Anderson extensively cites the civil cases which were cited by me in our brief in support of why res judicata should apply. So maybe coming back full circle to your initial question, if the U.S. Supreme Court says that res judicata has to apply, and I don't know that they've given us a four-part test, that's something that this court's created, but that would be a guide for us to use, and I don't know why we would apply a different type of test when this court's already used that test very successfully in the past on many occasions. It gives us an example of when it should be applied. I suppose the legal answer is we wouldn't have to use that four-part test, but I don't know why we would have a disconnect. One test in civil, yet a separate test in a criminal context.
The question is, do we use Blockberger? That's what it comes down to. I mean, that's where I'm going here.
If we use Blockberger, that would then mean we're not using res judicata, because that seems to be a very different principle in mind, because that's certainly what the court, when they were writing Ash versus Swenson, I mean, they were very aware of the Oppenheimer decision. It was something of the foundation for that opinion. Interestingly enough, didn't go back to Blockberger in writing their decision. If they were going to say Blockberger is what applies, they would not have adopted or used collateral estoppel. I've gone through in my brief the four points, or rather the four elements of res judicata. I think that this is a very clear case when we look to Roush v. Bank of Hovind. We're really dealing with the same trial. The parties had the same full and fair opportunity to previously litigate this issue. When we're talking about the first element, the issue to be decided in the former adjudication is identical to this most recent. And this court has consistently fleshed that out by saying, well, what we're really talking about is what is the wrong that's to be redressed when we're coming into the second litigation.
And how are those identical then between the first trial and the second trial?
The harm is the same really in both trials. We're calling it different names. In the first, we're calling it aggravated grand theft. And in the second, we're calling it fraud. But really what the state's trying to do is secure a conviction for what they're alleging is my client's wrongful conduct involved in the Goldtown Hotel transaction. So just like in the Roush cases, first set of documents come forward, the bank's trying to collect on those notes, the Supreme Court in the first litigation says you can't collect on those, I believe it was the 79 or the 81 notes. Bank says, okay, let's try again. They use a separate set of bank notes. They try to collect on that, and this court says, look, it's the same harm. Yes, they're different notes, but what you're really trying to do is recapture this bad loan.
But here you have separate crimes. You have the aggravated theft, basically, versus forgery. How are those identical harms?
Because they deal with the same transaction. It's still an attempt to redress what occurred with my client's conduct involving the Gold Town Hotel. So it's, of course, in one sense, it's a crime against the peace and dignity of the state of South Dakota. But in another sense, it's Barbara Langlois, who has been the victim of these crimes, and her grandson, my client's son, Dale. So really analogous to Roush, or analogous really to almost any other time this court's applied res judicata. For purposes of are we dealing with the same wrong to be redressed, we are. I'll move on. Maybe I'll make this argument. If the court doesn't apply res judicata in some fashion, we'd be left with kind of this awkward spot where a criminal litigant is able to apply for double jeopardy under the traditional Blockberger analysis. Kind of skips that middle step. He's able to go and apply for the more limited protection under collateral estoppel. But for whatever reason, he's not able to apply for that res judicata. A civil litigant could. The criminal litigant could not. Also, I don't know if ironic is the right word. The state can certainly use res judicata in the criminal context and use it. I always get confused if we're using things as a sword or a shield. That was the analogy we were taught. But they're able to use that doctrine to preclude a criminal litigant from raising arguments, but he is apparently bound. I don't think that's the law. I don't think that's what this court has ever written, and I don't believe that's what the Supreme Court of the United States intended when they did Oppenheimer, Blockberger, and Ash v. Swenson. The issue of venue in this case, in my humble opinion, is a very interesting one. We have State versus Sullivan, which the state has cited extensively. And we have State versus Iwan, which, of course, I have cited extensively. It's our position when looking at venue that really the Iwan case is controlling, and it's almost, it's very, very, very close. It's almost on all fours, the Iwan decision and those facts, with the case that we have here. There's no evidence that Mr. Thomason forged or was in possession with the intent to defraud that forged power of attorney in Lawrence County. The evidence is that he shows up in Sioux Falls, has that document. That document's then utilized to then at that point procure the new deed, which is count three. So everything happens in Sioux Falls, or that's the evidence of where everything happens, very similar to what took place in Iwan, where Mr. Iwan hands the bad check in his county to that delivery fuel driver who then takes the check and leaves. So the false documents are there in Sioux Falls, Lincoln County. It's then the independent company, Getty Abstract, that then says, okay, now we're going to send these for filing. We're going to overnight them to Lawrence County, which is very similar to what happened in the Iwan case. It was the company and the delivery driver that actually utilized the mails and actually had the quotation was the pigeons came home to roost in that county because of that action. Similar to Iwan, one of the, I think, primary factors there was, look, Mr. Iwan didn't know what was going to happen with those checks. The state's arguing, well, based on a pattern of conduct, he must have, but this court said there's just no evidence to that. The same thing here, Mr. Thomason is in Sioux Falls. There's no evidence that he knew or that there would be some kind of, I know we don't use this language, but it's almost like a purposeful contacts or a minimum contacts analysis that he knew that was going to occur with Lawrence County.
Except he knew, he obviously knew that he had to get clear title. And so he knew that meant filing deeds in the Register of Deeds office, filing documents to get clear title so he could get the money for the refinance.
So he So he knows he needs clear title. That doesn't necessarily mean that he knows that the documents are going to have to be filed in Lawrence County. I don't know that that's a fair assumption any more than it was in Iowan to say, well, look, he must know that the business is in another county. Therefore, he has, I'm going to borrow some language, purposely availed himself to the venue of that other county. A little different than Sullivan, where the phone salesman is calling people in the county he ultimately ends up in, reaching out to them and attempting to do his defraud. That would be the sense in which there he shows up. I thank the court, and I will reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Gray. Ms. Sirska, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. In 2005, defendant and his wife, Kim Thomason, purchased the Gold Town Hotel in Lead, South Dakota, from the Bennetts. Defendant's mother-in-law, Barbara, loaned defendant and Kim $50,000 for a deposit to buy the hotel on a contract for deed. In exchange for that loan, Barbara received a quitclaim deed to the property, which she did not file at that time. The Bennetts held the deed to the hotel. Defendant and Kim ran the business with defendant's son, Dale. In 2006, the Bennetts commenced a foreclosure proceeding against the Thomasons to get the hotel back because of missed payments. Barbara took out a loan against her Florida property in the amount of $328,000 to pay the Bennetts back and end the foreclosure action. Barbara testified that Kim and defendant then received the deed and the three of them went to file the deed. In 2007, Barbara had not been paid her money back from the Thomasons, which Barbara testified at that time totaled over $500,000. Barbara contacted an attorney to collect the money she loaned to defendant, and she then filed the quitclaim deed to the hotel. On January 7th, 2008, defendant and Barbara agreed to a letter of intent stating if defendant paid Barbara $200,000 by January 14th of 2008, Barbara would then quit claim the hotel back to defendant and Kim. The agreement to quit claim the hotel to defendant was so that he could get a loan against the hotel to repay Barb the remaining money defendant owed her. Defendant and Kim signed the letter of intent and received the quitclaim deed upon signing. The deed named defendant, Kim, and Dale as owners in joint tenancy with the right of survivorship. Barbara added Dale's name to the deed because Dale had also loaned defendant and Kim money for the use of the hotel and had not been paid back. On January 10th, 3 days after defendant and Kim signed that letter of intent, defendant and Kim traveled to Sioux Falls, where they sold the hotel for $350,000 to the Vinsons, who then leased the business back. In order to sell the hotel, defendant and Kim needed Dale's signature at closing because Dale's name was on the property. Defendant and Kim contacted Dale to sign the special power of attorney and told Dale it was for a loan. Dale was in Illinois at the time and testified that he refused to sign anything without reading it. Dale further testified that he would be back in time to be present for the closing and would not need to sign the power of attorney. Defendant and Kim became agitated when Dale refused to sign the special power of attorney and later told Dale that they found a way to do the closing without him and did not need his help. Because Dale's refusal to sign the special power of attorney was getting in defendant's way of selling the hotel, defendant presented a forged special power of attorney giving the authority to sign Dale's name and sell the property. Defendant presented the forged special power of attorney at Getty Abstract in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to close the sale of the hotel and set in motion for the forged special power of attorney and warranty deed to be filed in Lawrence County. Upon closing, defendant and Kim received three checks for $68,000 each, made out to the three title owners, defendant, Kim, and Dale. Defendant endorsed the check payable to Dale, converted the funds for his own use without Dale's knowledge.
You know, it's been some time since I did real estate work as an attorney. Was the original forged power of attorney filed with the Register of Deeds in Lawrence County or just the deed?
Both the forged special power of attorney and the warranty deed were filed at the Lawrence County Register of Deeds.
All right. Thank you.
After the sale, defendant Kim went to the Dominican Republic and stayed there for the next 4 to 5 years. Barbara did not receive her $200,000 by the specified date in the letter of intent, so Barbara's attorney contacted defendant. Defendant claimed that the loan had closed and that the check had been deposited on January 14th and would take 7 to 10 days for the check to clear. After around a month, Barbara still did not receive her money. A title search was done, and she discovered that the hotel had been sold in violation of the terms of the agreement of the letter of intent, and that a special power of attorney was utilized, giving defendant the right to sign Dale's name. It was also discovered the warranty deed had transferred Ken, Kim, and Dale's interest to the Vincents. Dale's name was also executed on the warranty deed by power of attorney. Defendant was indicted and convicted of aggravated grand theft by deception of over $100,000, which is reversed by this court, holding Barbara did not have interest in the property. Defendant was subsequently indicted on 2 counts of forgery and 2 counts of offering false or forged instrument for filing, registering, or recording. Defendant was convicted by jury on all 4 counts. The first issue is whether defendant's previous prosecution of aggravated grand theft bars subsequent prosecution for forgery and offering false or forged instrument for filing. Defendant argues the state should be precluded from charging and convicting him of forgery and offering a forged instrument for filing based on double jeopardy and res judicata because defendant was previously acquitted on aggravated grand theft.
Do you concede that there are no new facts to justify the new charges that were not known at the time of the original trial?
No, Your Honor. There were additional facts presented at trial. The state brought in 2 additional witnesses, John Billion, who was the general counsel at Getty Abstract, and also Ruth Wires, who's a senior title examiner at the Lawrence Title Company. John Billion testified to at the closing. The Getty Abstract overnighted the documents, the deed and the special power of attorney, to the Lawrence County Title Company.
Does that go to just the venue charge, or does that go to the forgery charge, those facts? Is there any way those facts relate to the forgery charge?
Yes, Your Honor. It's additional evidence that was presented. It goes to the first issue, to double jeopardy and res judicata, because it shows that these are 2 distinct and separate prosecutions. The first prosecution of the aggravated grand theft was a claim against, it was theft of Barbara's and her interest in the property. Here, the claim is forging Dale's signature on the special power of attorney and the warranty deed in order to get the money, and specifically the money from Dale. So in addition to 2 entirely separate claims and 2 entire and distinct prosecutions, there are different victims here.
Was the existence of the forged power of attorney known to the state at the time of the first trial?
Well, yes, Your Honor. However, it was only used to bring in evidence of the forgery was to prove the intent to defraud the aggravated grand theft. There wasn't a final judgment on the merits regarding whether there was a forgery or offering false or forged instrument for filing.
I guess my question was, they knew of the existence of the document.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
If the court were to look at the Blockberger test, it is clear that the issue and the claim are different than in the first trial. The Blockberger test reads, where the same offense or claim constitutes a violation of two distinct statutory provisions, the test to be applied to determine whether the two offenses or only one is whether each provision requires proof of an additional fact where the other does not. The application of the Blockberger test makes plain that aggravated grand theft by deception is not the same offense as forgery and offering a forged instrument for filing. The statute at issue clearly requires proof of an additional fact that the other does not. Additionally, this case, in State v. Weaver, this court applied the Blockberger test to determine whether the subsequent prosecutions should have been barred under former jeopardy. If the court were to apply the res judicata test, as defendant has argued, it is evident that the defendant had not established all four prongs of the res judicata test. We have already established that there are different issues from the former adjudication to the present issue. Aggravated grand theft is a completely separate and distinct issue and claim, as in the forgery and offering a false or forged instrument for filing.
But in the first trial, wasn't the use of the power of attorney part of what was claimed as the aggravated grand theft, or that was a part of the fraud that was claimed? Was it that forged power of attorney was utilized?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's what they alleged, anyway.
It was part of the whole scheme. And this is one more thing for the jury to consider when determining the intent to deceive. However, they weren't required to make that determination of forgery and offering to file the forged instrument for filing. Because it's a completely separate and distinct component and prosecution. There was not a final judgment on the merits whether a forgery and offering to file a forged instrument in the first trial. The final judgment was on whether there was aggravated grand theft and whether Barbara had an interest in the property. Defendant argues that the parties in the two actions are the same or in privity, and while the state is prosecuting defendant in this Thomason 2, there are different victims. Barbara is the victim in the first trial, and Dale and the public are the victims in the second trial.
Does that matter? I mean, the parties are the state and Mr. Thomason.
Yes, Your Honor, it does matter. It's completely two and separate distinct prosecutions. There are two different harms here. There was the harm against Barbara in the first trial, and then the harm against Dale and the public in the second trial. Defendant further argues that there was a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issues in the prior adjudication. However, because this is a separate and distinct prosecution, there is no authority to preclude the issue. Could it have been litigated, but wasn't. As this court held in State v. Pickering, and I did not include that in my briefs, but I provided copies for the court and opposing counsel.
Thank you.
This court held a single act may be an offense against two statutes, and if each statute requires proof of an additional fact that the other does not, an acquittal or conviction under either statute does not exempt the defendant from prosecution or punishment under the other. Therefore, a defendant did not establish the burden to prove that res judicata has been met. Defendant failed to establish the elements necessary to prove aggravated grand theft and forgery and offering to file a forged instrument, and therefore defendant's subsequent prosecution did not violate double jeopardy and therefore res judicata. The second issue is whether venue was proper in Lawrence County. Defendant argues the proper venue is Lincoln County because defendant provided the special power of attorney in Sioux Falls. However, the trial court denied defendant's motion to dismiss for lack of venue. The trial court held that the state had set forth sufficient evidence to put the matter to the jury with regard to the issue of venue. The jury was instructed on statutes 23A, 16-8, and 23A, 16-14 when considering venue. 23A, 16-8 reads, when a public offense is committed partly in one county and partly in another county, or the acts or effects thereof constituting or requisite to the offense occur in two or more counties, the venue is in either county. Defendant passed the forged instrument to close the sale and file and record in Lawrence County. He set that action in motion. While Getty facilitated the closing, the execution of the documents, and they overnighted the documents where they needed to go, in this case, Lawrence County. 23A, 16-14 reads, where the commission of the public offense involves the use of mails, the venue of the offense is in any county where the letter is deposited or delivered, or where it is received by the person to whom it's addressed. Here, this case did involve the mailing, where defendant set in motion for Getty Abstract to forward the defendant's forged documents to Lawrence County. And defendant argued in State v. Iwan that there is no evidence that defendant knew that the documents had to be filed in Lawrence County. However, the state provided sufficient evidence for the jury to infer the defendant had knowledge that the documents had to be filed in Lawrence County. For example, State's Exhibit 25, which is settled record, pages 397 to 399, is the owner's affidavit that defendant and Kim signed at closing. And on the top of the page says, return to Lawrence County Title Company, and gives the address. And defendant and Kim signed that on January 10th, 2008. Additionally, State's Exhibit 22, pages 394 through 396, was the settlement statement provided at closing, where it detailed the charges out in closing, and there are charges made to the Lawrence County Treasurer, Lawrence County Register of Deeds, and Lawrence County Title Company, and defendant and Kim signed the acknowledgement of receipt for the settlement statement. If you turn to Defendant's Exhibit A, which is settled record, page 409, this is email correspondence between defendant and Barbara's attorney discussing the letter of intent and the deed that Barbara was going to convey to defendant, Kim, and Dale. The email from defendant to the attorney reads in pertinent part, Brad, I'm preparing a document for you at this time. I suggest you prepare a quitclaim deed for Barbara back to Kim and I, and one for Kim and I back to Barbara. If you can meet me at the Lawrence County Courthouse today so we can get the one filed, I think we will just have a delay in closing. Pages 349, settled record pages 349, 350, 362 and 365 are part of State's Exhibit 12 that was introduced at trial. And this is also email correspondence between defendant and Barbara's attorney discussing, again, this letter of intent and the deed that was going to be conveyed to them. On January 3rd, 2008, defendant wrote to attorney, I read in pertinent part, I will get you the document in the morning early. You may have to meet me in Deadwood as to get the other one filed. January 4th, defendant replies to attorney regarding the letter of intent and deed. Defendant writes, in pertinent part, this needs to be filed today or we are going to have problems. Can Gina bring it to Deadwood or any other remedies that you can think of? Further, on January 7th, when the attorney emailed defendant that he would fax the document of the letter of intent that he must sign before the attorney will fax the deed to defendant. Defendant replies, and I read in pertinent part, "That sounds great. Don't we need the original document to file at the courthouse?" Lastly, on page 365 of the settled record, and this is still in State's Exhibit 12, an email from defendant to attorney reads in pertinent part, "Also, the document that you want us to sign, if you email it to me, I can print it out here and sign and then fax to you. Find out if they are going to need the original quit claim at the courthouse so we can figure out a way to get it there and be filed." Therefore, the state provided under a preponderance of evidence that the jury could infer that defendant had the knowledge that the documents had to be filed in Lawrence County. Therefore, the evidence was sufficient for the jury to determine the venue was in Lawrence County was proper. And the state respectfully requests the court to affirm defendant's conviction in all respects.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Sersku. Mr. Gray, you have 10 minutes, sir, for rebuttal.
Thank you. What I propose to do is hopefully articulate a clear question to Justice Inner's, or more articulate answer to Justice Inner's question about why race judicata, why the four elements. I'll then distinguish State versus Pickering and follow up on your question about why it is, how do these crimes overlap, Justice Wilbur. So race judicata is a policy of, well, it's similar to a statute of limitations. Perhaps today I'm driving along, I hit a hole on the highway, and I have a good case, potentially. Statute of limitations passes, that's the only thing, the day goes by, and I lose my right. And that might seem strange to the outside world. Why would he lose his claim because time has passed? Well, there has to be a policy. At some point, litigation needs to end. Race judicata is the same way. It is designed to make sure that we don't waste judicial resources on trying cases again and again, and so people don't have to go through vexatious litigation. So what happens if we quash or change or we meld race judicata and double jeopardy and we say, well, we're going to treat them at one? Race judicata really is Blockburger, and Blockburger in the criminal context really is just race judicata. There's not a separate test. What that would mean is that the protection to civil litigants would be much broader than it would be to criminal litigants. A criminal litigant would have to come forward and establish the Blockburger test. If they couldn't, or if they couldn't establish collateral estoppel under Ash versus Swenson, they would be subjected to that continual retrial. This would be an example of that case. The same almost identical facts in every material respect. But the state gets to just keep trying it so long as it has a different theory that doesn't run afoul of collateral estoppel or Blockburger. This would be that type of a case where we show the success of the
case. Well, she spent a good portion of her time trying to emphasize to us the different facts as far as the power of attorney, the different players, and everything else, that it wasn't a carbon copy of the first litigation.
Not a carbon copy. I didn't mean to cut you off.
That was it.
Not a carbon copy, and so that will kind of bring you then to Justice Wilbur's question. Okay, is this close enough? Is this right there? Just like in Roush, it's not carbon copy litigation. We're dealing with different banknotes. Okay, here, why is this the same? Why are we dealing with really the same harm? That's because in the first trial, the state's saying, look, something bad happened with the litigation, with the Gold Town Hotel transaction. And the thrust of the state's closing goes, look at this forged power of attorney. This goes to show intent. This goes to show the bad conduct. This helps to prove the intent for aggregated grand theft. So it's really dealing with the same issue. When we come to the second trial, it's not carbon copied. It's almost reversed. Look, the guy made this shady deal. He then took off. He didn't pay. That helps to prove the forgery. So we're dealing with the same operative facts. Now, it's true the state called Attorney Billion, called another member of Getty Abstract, but those weren't substantively new issues, and more importantly, the state had the full and fair opportunity to litigate that matter. That's not like a case where suddenly they did more discovery and found out about those witnesses. They just chose to present the Getty abstract information through those witnesses as opposed to Mr. Vinson.
So you're saying the difference in the second trial was venue is an issue and it wasn't in the first. And that's why we get Mr. Billion's appearance and the other witnesses.
I don't know. I'm guessing because Mr. Fitzgerald didn't tell us why those witnesses. I'd assume that businessman Mr. Vinson was unavailable. That was my guess. So therefore, we have Mr. Billion who can come testify about the actual transaction. Maybe the intent was for venue. I don't know.
Well, I guess maybe I didn't ask the question well enough. If venue had never been an issue in the second trial, what would have been different on the facts from the second trial to the first? And maybe I'm throwing you a softball. Is there none? If venue had not been an issue in the second trial, thus bringing in Mr. Billion and the other witnesses, say there was no venue in the second trial, do we basically have the same evidence, same testimony in the two cases?
Absolutely. We have the same witnesses. We have almost identical documents, the same emails, and, of course, the forged power of attorney and the bank notes and everything else. So it would be the same. But importantly, the state had access to all this information. There was no bar from having them bring forward these charges during the first litigation. For whatever reason, they just chose not to. So in that way, it's going back to the policy argument. It's like the man with the injured leg and the injured arm. He sues the defendant for the auto accident, claims the injury to his leg, doesn't bring up the arm. Let's say he loses at the first trial. Okay, well, I still have this injured arm. Let's talk about this now. It's a separate issue. No, it really isn't. We're still addressing the same harm. Res judicata should apply. I'm kind of bouncing back and forth. I'm going to do something a bit risky. I'm going to cite to a case I didn't read in preparation for today. It's, I believe, State versus Jack Hagen. It's a case dealing with the Speedy Trial Act, or what we call the 180-day rule. In State versus Hagen, more than 180 days had elapsed. It looked like a good claim for dismissal on 180. This court, I forget the procedural posture, but came back and said, no, in civil law, things aren't told until orders are finally disposed of and a written order comes in. My point being, this court, and rightly so, frequently applies civil law in the criminal context and vice versa. So going back to Justice Zinner's question, why should we use four elements from civil law, is because we always use, it's the same body of law. There might be differences. It might be presumption of innocence. It might be preponderance of the evidence. But we still apply these doctrines uniformly in most settings. State versus Hagen, if I'm remembering the name correctly, would be such a case. So now I'm bouncing back a little bit to your question, Justice Wilburn.
Let's talk about Pickering.
Yes. All right. What do we do with Pickering? Because on first glance, it could appear to be, hey, it doesn't say this, but it could be Blockberger and res judicata really kind of meld together. Importantly, this decision doesn't mention res judicata. It'd be interesting to know what the case would have looked like had res judicata been argued, as opposed to, because really what this is rejecting is Justice Brennan's transactions test that he gave in his concurrence in Ash v. Swenson. So really, I think that's what this case is dealing with. But here's what I think is telling. Then Judge Miller points out in the second paragraph, okay, the defendant goes through his first trial. He's acquitted. Shortly thereafter, a new complaint, apparently based upon the defendant's testimony at trial. So would this be a good case for the traditional or the four-pronged res judicata test? Perhaps not. Because here, the state would not have had a full and fair opportunity to litigate the new receipt of stolen property charge. You know, it doesn't say in here, but reading between the lines, I mean, we know that he's charged with theft. He must have testified at trial. Perhaps he said something to the effect, I didn't steal it, I just had it. Well, that's new information that the state now has that they couldn't have had before. He has a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. They can't take interrogatories or depose him. They now have new information, perhaps that would take it out of res judicata. So is this a res judicata case? No, because it doesn't discuss it. No, because if it does, it runs afoul of Oppenheimer, and more importantly, I think that this case would not lend itself, or at least potentially if we had access to the full trial record. It doesn't sound like the prosecutor had everything or a full and fair opportunity, because he had new evidence after the first trial.
But it is similar because it's two separate crimes.
It is.
Rather than the second trial.
So maybe that first element of, hey, we're dealing with the same harm, would overlap. So if we ran a res judicata analysis and said, okay, element one might very well be met. It might be the same alleged victim. It might be the same stuff going on. But more importantly, it's the same harm that's trying to be redressed. Do we have that fourth element, which is everyone had a fair and full opportunity to litigate?
Is that the test? The same? It's got to be the same harm, or it's got to be the same issue?
Both. As my reading of this court's jurisprudence on that issue is, when you're talking about the litigation being the same, it's addressing the same harm. Hence the, hey, it's my leg for the first lawsuit. Okay, well, it's a separate issue. It's my arm. No, it's not a separate issue. It's really the same harm. Or in the Roush case, I think, is a good example. We're really dealing with trying to recapture money. On the venue issue, I'll simply wrap it up by saying that it appears that everything happened in Minnehaha, I'm sorry, Lincoln County, and my client did not use the mails. That was very similar to Iwan, somebody else doing that. For those reasons, we request that this matter be remanded with instructions, and on behalf of Mr. Thomason, I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, Mr. Gray. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow, 10? Okay, we're in recess.